The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hello, Dr. Ray.
Hi, Dr. Ray. How are you?
I'm sure I'm going to get really good advice from you.
Well, I don't know about that.
You're right on track with this. You're right on track.
My idea, my theory, my guidance is a bit of a stretch.
Everybody make a mistake.
Does that comfort you?
No.
Am I close?
No.
You are so wrong.
You're so wonderful.
Why do I have to be the insightful professional?
Someone intelligent on the radio. Yay!
Did I make you feel a lot better or what?
No, you made me feel worse.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
It is the hometown of Mother Angelica, and indeed, my childhood parish was St. Anthony's in the southeast end of Canton, Ohio, where all the Italians settled shortly after the turn of the 20th century. They came in from Ellis Island, as did all four of my grandparents. St. Anthony's was heavy, heavy Italian. I used to sit and listen as they would announce who the masses were for each weekday. And interestingly enough, there were three weekday masses. Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I think it was a 6:30 and 7 or 6:37 and 7:30, and they had people at them. And I would listen to 9 out of 10 of the masses were for someone with Italian lineage. Canton, Ohio. Mother Angelica went to St. Anthony's. I got my first communion, my confirmation at St. Anthony's, graduated from CCD at St. Anthony's. My dad went to St. Anthony's little school. Just a little backdrop. Of course, I didn't know Mother Angelica at that time. I was only 7. This is The Doctor Is In. This is E-Person Monday. I had to find a way to address many of the email that come in, some regarding comments, some regarding corrections, some regarding mostly situations. That's the most common email. Every so often, someone will write in and either correct me or tell me how horribly I handled somebody's call, what I was doing wrong, and that I was evil. And I hate when my relatives write me like that. I block most of them. No, not true. But every so often, anybody who's in this business, even the religious media business, they're going to get those. It's going to happen. Okie dokie. So, what do I want to talk about? In the past, one of the things I talked about was people sitting on the end of the pew in Mass, and I would say minimally 9 out of 10 will not move in if you come to the end of the pew and want to move in. I'm not going to go any further on this because it got an awful lot of response and people offering reasons why they sit on the end of the pew and don't move. And I'm fascinated by the various ways that we express the faith, small ways, tiny ways. For example, you know, the Our Father, you got some people taking the posture of the priest with their arms out. You got some people holding hands. These things kind of gain momentum. And I've been noticing something, and I want to double underline before I go any further this qualification. This is not to impugn or critique anyone who is a Christian but not Catholic. I have many relatives who are faith-filled Christians, but they're not Catholic. I have many friends. Not unusually, when you have an ecumenical group of Catholics and non-Catholics, somebody's going to say the prayer. The Catholics typically, even if they're not saying the prayer, make the sign of the cross before and after the prayer. The non-Catholics, of course, do not. If the Catholic is leading the prayer, let's say we're going to say the routine, bless us, O Lord, these thy gifts. typically, if the Catholic is leading the prayer and you've got 8 or 10 or 12 or 15 people there at the gathering, some of them good Christians but not Catholics. The Catholics will make the sign of the cross. The Christians will not at all. I don't recall ever seeing a non-Catholic make the sign of the cross. Now, why is that perplexing to me, you might say? The sign of the cross, if you know anything about its history, is one of the very, very oldest prayers in Christianity. Not unusual, way back in apostolic days, for someone to identify themselves with a particular mark on their forehead. And Christians would mark themselves with the sign of the cross, a cross. It was a very, very, very early prayer of identity. And of course, it's become a most common Catholic prayer before, after, during blessings. It's very pervasive. Why wouldn't someone who isn't Catholic, but is a very faith-filled Christian, never make the sign of the cross? They may not know its history, but I think that even if they knew its history, it wouldn't matter. Why not? Now, my wife and she and I were talking about this morning. She said, well, Ray, they're not Catholic. They're not going to make the sign of the cross. I said, I understand that. But when someone who is not a Catholic makes a prayer that is leaning toward a Protestant style of expression. For example, when I was in the evangelical world, the word just was big. So we just ask you, dear Father, for traveling mercies because we just know that you will be there when we need you, and we are just so grateful that you're there, and we just hope that you would, and just was big. All right. I found that kind of ironic that one of the objections to Catholics is that we had rote prayers. And I always said, well, isn't the Our Father a rote prayer? Well, they don't call it the Our Father, they call it the Lord's Prayer. So why not? We're back to why not the sign of the cross? I think it's because it is so distinctly identifiable with Catholics that if they were to make the sign of the cross, they would fill it with meaning other than simply making this prayer. I had a lady say to me once, this was at a church softball game. I was playing for a non-denominational evangelical, and she said, yeah, well, you Catholics make that triangle on yourself, whatever that is. I remember saying, you always make fun of stuff you don't understand. Kind of like a Columbo, you know. I didn't understand why she was saying these things. But in the extreme, she views it as that's something just identifiably Catholic. And I'm not going to do it. And I often wonder, beyond a simple, I'm not Catholic, that's a Catholic prayer, so therefore I don't do that. I often wonder, is there more to it for some people? Would that be admitting that the Catholic Church at least has some things correct? If you make the sign of the cross, of course, it doesn't mean that you believe everything that the Catholic Church teaches. It doesn't mean that. But I think in their mind, it might be a little bit too close to that. They fill it with meaning that it doesn't have. If they made the sign of the cross in our home when I lead the prayer, those of us who are Catholic, of course, before and after the prayer, we make the sign of the cross. Those who are not, don't. They simply bow their heads. And I've often wondered, what do you think you're saying by simply making the sign of the cross. And if I were to say, you know, that's pretty much one of the oldest prayers in Christianity. It's been handed down for 2,000 years. I still don't think that would make all that much difference. That's the stuff I think about. Not too often, though. Usually I think about, should he have called a draw play on 3rd and 12? I wouldn't have. This is Dr. Ray.
You're listening to The Doctor. Come in. Pull up a couch. Let's talk. The doctor is in.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jangle.
St. Ignatius of Loyola encourages us in the sixth rule of his 14 rules for the discernment of spirits to practice much examination when we are experiencing spiritual desolation. We may find ourselves in the struggle of spiritual desolation, uncertain as to how it even began. Practicing much examination is to go within our hearts and ask, when did this desolation begin? Instead of distracting ourselves to avoid the difficulty of going within, practicing much examination redirects us from diversion and causes us to look at the source of the spiritual desolation. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, "The much examination that Ignatius counsels here directly counters such flight into diversion. In the time of the spiritual desolation itself, we interiorly stop and ask, am I in spiritual desolation? What action will help me to reject it?"
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
Stephen Janet Ray here, announcing we are back in the Holy Land, ready to introduce you to our favorite places in the world, the land where God walked. Mass at the most holy sites, pray the mysteries of the rosary where they happened, and experience the Bible in vivid color. We have led over 100 groups through this land, sharing the whole story of salvation. Of all the pilgrimages in all of the world, this is the one you should not miss.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at AveMariaRadio.net.
Dr. Ray Guarendi here. Program Doctor is In, Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. My website, drray.com, D-R-R-A-Y.com. Most recent book is there, Drama-Free Discipline, as well as about 16 other titles, variously about the faith, about living more with the mind of Christ, marriage, how to get along with people, anxiety reduction, all this stuff. It's there. All of them come with a Springer guarantee. You or your child will never be on the former Jerry Springer or any program like it. This is E-Person Monday. Hello, Dr. Ray. Thank you for your encouragement for us older people regarding exercise. Just show up. Yes, that is a mantra. I was listening to a fellow named Peter Attia. Attia has a podcast called The Drive. Attia is a surgeon. I think he's a general surgeon. He is heavy, heavy into the research involving strength training, physical fitness, various aspects of health. He calls it health span. Everybody wants a long lifespan, but health span is what they really want. And Attia talks, and he said something the other day was interesting. He said, every single person, no matter their age, and again, he was probably excluding kids under 12, 13, should pursue some kind of strength training. The research is overwhelming for its benefits. Now, this particular writer said, I like cycling the most. I will be passing 34,000 miles on my bicycle this month. I'm assuming he's not talking a stationary bike, that he's actually talking one of these really neat cross-country type bikes. I'm 61 and feel better now in a number of ways, better than when I was 25. That is true. I have seen people come into the weight room who are say 28, 30 years old, and they aren't close in terms of strength and ability to someone who is 65 in there who has been doing this for years and years. Not even close. This can help your listeners, Dr. Ray, but for myself, I don't like the gym. Well, there is a certain amount of travel involved. There is a certain amount of motivation to get up and go that's involved. But he says, at no cost, therefore, I exercise at home. Push-ups, sit-ups, chin-ups. That's a tough exercise. And squats with any amount of weight, holding a gallon of milk or water, a piece of wood, piece of steel. So he is moving his body. Resistance is what he's doing. I tell myself this when I start exercising and I don't want to do it. Here's what he says. Do it for the Lord. Your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit. He's right, you know. For those of us who have bodies so far functioning reasonably well, Lord wants us to take care of it, especially given the way we eat, the sedentary existence of many, perhaps most, and we're being riddled with chronic disorders and illnesses, diabetes, high blood pressure, heavy cholesterol. These things are in many ways fixable through lifestyle changes. He says, you talked about the effects of handwriting versus typing. Yes, I did. Talked about research coming out for a couple of positives involved in handwriting. One, I've noticed that when I write it out longhand, cursive, you know, that's a code that people can't read anymore. Military can use it, you know, and they send out messages that they don't want to be conquered. They don't want to be, what's the word is, assessed. They write it in cursive. That's right. He says, I have experienced just the opposite, Dr. Ray. The best class I ever had was typing in high school. Well, it was a good class for me, too, because this really cute girl asked me out, but that doesn't have anything to do with high school class typing. I remember in college when trying to write papers, no computers were available. Yes, I wrote in cursive. But many times I had ideas in my head, and I couldn't write them on paper before I forgot them. That happens to me all the time. Relentlessly, I'll come up with an idea for a monologue, and I don't write it down. And it's gone within an hour. Sometimes I'll ask my wife, what did I say, honey, that I was going to talk about tomorrow on the program? It was almost a new world for me when I had to write a letter or a paper at work. I type now most of my texts. I send them first on my home computer and then email them to my phone. This is from Jerry. So he's had a different experience with that. Let's take a brief question that came in. Clinically speaking, Dr. Ray, are worry and anxiety the same thing? They're related. Worry creates anxiety, and what if worries are the most treacherous of anxiety creating worries? Because what if worries are concoctions of the mind that may or may not have a likelihood of happening. And furthermore, they may be beyond your control to do anything about. What if I get dementia like my grandfather did? And you're 51 years old. Well, other than living a healthier lifestyle and doing some things, you can't guarantee you won't. What if our baby is not born healthy? Now, fortunately, in both cases, the odds are in your favor. Most kids nowadays are born healthy and thriving, and it's still a small minority of people who will get dementia, although that percentage is getting larger because we're living longer. But given that, worry breeds anxiety. Anxiety is generally a broader condition. Anxiety has a lot of components. It has a physiological component, arousal that can be unpleasant. It has a cognitive component. What are you thinking about that is breeding the anxiety? Has an emotional component. I'm really, really distressed over being anxious. So anxiety is the much broader word. Worry is a little more narrow. Some people are chronic worriers. They will find something to worry about. Some people think that if I worry about it, that makes it less likely to happen. Shrinks call that magical thinking. My worry can keep it from happening. Well, that's not going to happen at all. You can worry all you want, and it's not going to change anything. Some worry has a plan. In other words, let's say you're planning a wedding, or you're planning a party. It's your grandma's 85th birthday. Where are you going to have it? Who are you going to invite? What kind of food? How much? Will I get the house ready in time? Where are people going to park? Do we need entertainment? So you have all these smaller worries that are building. But once the party's over, once you have attempted to plan for these conditions, the worry's gone. It's over. The party's done. Same thing with the wedding. People get really anxious planning for a wedding. But once the wedding's passed, all the anxiety's gone. Some worries don't go away. Your kid's away at college. And the whole time, you're worrying. Is he safe? Is he going to stay in the faith? Is he going to get decent enough grades that he succeeds? What if he flunks out and has to come home? See, all of these worries are ongoing, and in many respects, you can't do anything about them. He's away at college. You have to hope that what you did in raising him would be enough to sustain him and help him navigate through all of the independence that he's going to experience at college if he is sent away to college. So some worries really don't have a plan to them. They're just, what if it happens? And those are the kind of worries that can really torment you. Because you could conceivably worry about everything. And part of the irony to a worry is that much of what we worry about is much less likely to happen. I saw a survey that listed the top 10 worries of people. Terrorist attack, physical assault, plane crash, shark attack. These are long, long shot worries in most people's lives. But they become part of our conscious efforts because, well, we've seen them on the news and the media tells us. And therefore, it creates this bent perception of likelihood. We think it's far more likely than it really is. And ironically, some of the things we should be concerned about, like our physical health and what we eat and watching our weight, well, those don't really make the top 10, which is ironic. So I gotta find that survey because I'm working right now on a book dealing with worry. And I remember that survey. I was shocked by what people tagged as their top worries. Worry and anxiety. Worry's part of anxiety. Worry can foment anxiety. But anxiety is the much broader experience.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
Brothers and sisters, we got to tell the truth in this country. For heaven's sakes, I wouldn't want to go to a synagogue and find that they were having a Muslim service. I wouldn't want to go to a mosque and run into a Baptist service. I don't want to go to a Baptist church and find out that they're having Mass. We've got to be honest to ourselves. We've got to be what we are. I'd rather a good old-fashioned, honest agnostic than a phony Christian any day of the week. There are reluctant agnostics. There are atheists who are searching for God, and they may find him. But somebody who says they're doing something in the name of God, in the name of Christ, and God and Christ have nothing to do with it, is violating this commandment. I am the Lord your God. You shall not take my name in vain.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
He always starts with the good things. You know, the seven letters to the churches and the book of Revelation is a great way to write letters to other people, by the way, or to have conversations with other people. You start with what's going well. You do this, this, and this really well. I love it. Thank you. Here's what you're lacking. And I think for many of us as men, what the Lord's communicating at that second part of the letter or the second part of the conversation is, here's what we're lacking. You don't ever spend enough time with me. You have no idea what I'm trying to offer you in the gift of my friendship. Or if you do, you don't make time for it. And if you would but come to me, I would change your life like that. But you don't come. Not with the regularity that I want you to come. Not with the ardor and the fervor and the passion that I want you to come. I have a hunch, I have more than a hunch, that's what he says to me. And I got a hunch that's what he would say to many of us.
Little easy listening music. Hopefully some easy listening advice. This is Dr. Ray. The program Dr. is in, co-production EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network and Ave Maria Radio Communications there in Ann Arbor, Michigan. My producer man, Andrew Kruchek. Hello, Dr. Ray. A question for your radio show. Been a listener for 20 years. Whew. I haven't been a listener for 20 years. In the last year and a half, my husband of 24 years landed a new job. After retiring from the military several years ago, I encouraged him to take the job to get him out of the rut he was in. A few months later, I could see something suspicious was going on. A work Valentine's supper that, quote, did not include spouses. Highly unusual to have a Valentine dinner not including spouses. Then he went to a local festival that I really wanted both of us to go, but he went by himself. I later found out, probably somebody told her, he went with two 24-year-old females from work. He is 58. I questioned him. He insisted I was wrong to insinuate he did anything wrong. The year went by. And many little situations told me he is flirting with one of these young ladies from work, whom I found on his Facebook. She's very beautiful. For Halloween, he decides to get a Halloween costume for work, since they are all dressing up on Halloween there. After a year of all this, my suspicions, I decide enough is enough. And I go through his phone, only to find flirtatious texts from her that always includes the other female coworker. safe buffer, if you ask me. In other words, it's a group text with this other young lady on it. About 15 pictures of him posing with her several times at work in their costumes. A video of her chasing after him around at work. He's going along with it. I've approached him several times, and he has denied every scenario. Over and over. Finally, I pulled out the Bible, put his hand on it. He spilled the beans. The Valentine's party that, quote, did not include spouses, in fact did. He didn't tell me because of her. He admitted he'd been having a flirtatious relationship with her and was attracted to her, but swore he did nothing physical. Again, I found several receipts of him buying her lunch throughout the year. Again, his excuse, it's nothing, just friends at work. Now I believe I can no longer trust him, and I tell him I want a divorce. He panics. Says I'm his best friend, he never stopped loving me, and that everything will stop. He begs for no divorce. He's been divorced before. He seems to be trying really hard to be the loving husband he never was. It's hard for me to believe this is genuine. He's still working there, but he says he doesn't talk to her anymore. She doesn't know anything, so why would she stop? I feel betrayed and have a hard time believing anything he says. I want our marriage to work, but how can I trust when he has proven he will lie to keep himself in the safe zone? Any advice? Appreciated. Not unusual to find someone in a marriage to want both. To have the fun and the titillation of the attention of another relationship, especially if it's somebody dramatically younger, and yet still have all the long-term, broader benefits of a loving spouse. Not unusual. It sounds like, again, I'm speculating, your husband was forced to choose. He thought he could continue to do this, enjoy that, and still have a solid marriage. And when he found out from you that that can't be, it's not going to be both, he realized he's got to make a choice. You're in a position, if you want to save your marriage, to accept that, in fact, he is making an effort to sever this supposedly flirtatious relationship. Can't know if it goes any further, but at this point, you don't have any hard evidence that it has, but you can't know. You're going to find out if it's continuing. How do I know this? Well, because you found out before. So either he'll have to become much more careful, which will bother you because you'll think maybe he just went further underground with all this. But if your goal is to save the marriage, then you're going to have to will yourself to trust him that he says this kind of conduct has stopped. And to have some certainty that if it continues, you will know it. You will find out about it. There will be more parties at work, and you will be included in them. And if you're not, then you draw your own conclusions. Or if word gets back to you somehow, some way, and you know how you found out about some of this, whether it was phone search or Facebook search or whatever it was, you'll likely find out about it again if it's happening. And if you say, well, yeah, but they could go further underground and recognize that now it's somewhat out in the open and they better be much, much, much more cautious about it. Possible. But I would suspect It's like, my wife says I interrupt my own sentences. It's like a couple who comes in for marriage counseling because one or the other has had an adulterous relationship. And if one says, it's over, I'm not involved in it anymore, the other says, well, how can I trust that? And I'll say, well, you almost have to because you can't know. If in fact it's continuing, you will somehow find out about it. You have to assume that. But you're in a position to take the individual at his or her word, or else you're going to follow through with the threat of divorce. And that you said you didn't want.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The devil will always do his best to tempt you into sin until you get to that place where you love sin. That's what he wants. He wants you down there with him. And not because he loves you, he hates you. When you do what the enemy tempts you to do, he does it out of pure hatred.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Why does the Catholic Church value virginity? At the heart and center of all Christian life is Christ the Lord. The Catechism tells us that our bond with Christ takes precedence over all bonds, familial or social. From the Church's very beginning, there have been men and women who have forsaken marriage to follow the Lamb wherever he leads them. Christ himself has invited certain persons to follow him in this way of life, for which he remains the model. Virginity for the sake of the kingdom is an unfolding of baptismal grace, a powerful sign of the supremacy of a person's bond with Christ. It is also a sign that this bond recalls that marriage is a reality of this present age, which is passing away. St. John Chrysostom puts it well, "The most excellent good is something even better than what is admitted to be good." This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net. Thank you for joining me here on The Doctor Is In E-Person Monday. Let's get through this stack, as it used to be called, or now it is this scroll. Some time ago, I did an opening monologue on differences between men and women. Obviously, research has confirmed there are just huge innate differences between the male of the species and the female of the species. And one of the points that I made was the often overlooked significant difference between men and women, which is men, regardless of their education or their career, you can have a PhD nuclear physicist, you can have an orthopedic surgeon. Men love the Three Stooges. Women think they're ridiculous. That's not even funny. I mean, that's just foolish. Why even watch that? Well, this comes from Karen, who said, "Hi, Dr. Ray. I love the Three Stooges. Does that mean there's something wrong with me?" No, Karen, I think it means that you have the better aspect of both being a female and a male. She says, "I love silly humor." She did not mention anything about me at that point. All right, let's see what we got here. Go down, scrolling. See, that's that. Gerald, Steve, Ed. Okay, see what we got here. "My daughter has one child who primarily takes out her aggressive behavior on her mother. Not sure what the trigger is. Well, I think the trigger probably varies all over the place, but it's usually if mom telling the child to do something she doesn't want to do or telling her to stop doing something she wants to do. She will go into complete aggressive behavior, yelling at mom to leave her alone, kicking, hitting, scratching. Ooh. My trigger is embarrassment at some of these outbursts. I need to know several things. One, I need to know the age of the child. It sounds like this is a kid under 10, probably 5, 6, 7. And almost always with this kind of aggressive behavior, mom needs some dramatic improvements in her discipline style. She may be over-talking, over-reasoning, over-negotiating, not following through, being inconsistent, doing too much yelling. Whatever it is, there's something in the daughter who looks at mom and has developed a mindset of, I don't have to listen to you. And if you try to make me listen to you, you're going to see how mad I can get. Now, there's a key word here. She primarily takes out her aggressive behavior on mom, which means she's probably okay at school or preschool or with other people, or if there's a marriage, she doesn't do this to dad, which tells me that the daughter knows where and with whom she can push that hard. One of the things that someone who has great behavior problems with a particular child thinks is that something about this child is making her or him this way. More often, that's not the case. It is something within the interaction, and the interaction has gone on for a long time. This is not something that's a week old. This is something that's 5 years old or 6 years old or 10 years old. And the child has developed a very clear perception, demeanor, and attitude toward the parent, which expresses itself in nastiness, a lot of nastiness. The parent starts to think, and I see this all the time, the child gets diagnosed as something wrong with the child. Sometimes they take this child to therapy, and therapy for behavior problem kids is a really low success rate. You got to work with the parent. But what happens is, after enough of this, the parent starts to think, I got a demon seed on my hands here. When in fact, if the parent could make some strategic adjustments in her discipline, better follow through, more calm confidence, meaning what she says, holding the child accountable. For example, I get parents in my office where it has deteriorated to hitting the parent or kicking the parent. I will sit with the parent and say, what do you want to tell this child from this point forward that will happen if they lay an aggressive hand on you? What do you want? What about a 1 week total loss of privileges? You know, that's kind of serious behavior to physically assault a parent. It's not something that goes away generally. It manifests itself in other ways as a child gets older and moves out of these meltdown sort of fits, but they just become a little more sophisticatedly defiant. What do you want to do? The consequence has to be pretty significant here to stop this dead in its tracks. Second child, Dr. Ray. You had a program in the last months of 2025 regarding what words to use in communication with a child that totally doesn't listen. I don't recall that, but I do recall this. When a parent says a child doesn't listen, what they're really saying is they don't cooperate when I use just words. And I probably said something like, you make your request, and then you follow through with consequences. If you ask the child, please, I need you to pick up the stuff that you left out in the kitchen, and they don't. You don't ask a second time. You take the stuff for whatever amount of time you see fit. When you tell a child, quit tormenting her brother, and she does, what are you going to do about it? You don't say it nine times. Second time, something happens. Whether she goes to the corner, whether she goes to her bed. But Dr. A, if she doesn't listen, she's not going to do that. That's true. That's true. That's why I've always suggested on this program, defiance leads to loss of all privileges until cooperation. All privileges. I mean, parent, the average parent does not realize what they control. Control everything. Not doing it to be harsh. You're not doing it to be nasty. You're doing it to be kind because you don't want to fight with your kid like this. This is ugly. Nobody wants to fight with their kid like that. So you do what you need to do in terms of consequences and expectations so that you don't fight. The kid's not dumb. They're going to cooperate more likely if they know which behavior leads to what. Dr. Ray.
This program is brought to you by the following nonprofit underwriter.
Are you longing to hear God's voice? Lord, Teach Me to Pray, the free Ignatian Prayer Series will open your heart to His voice, to the peace you are seeking and the only love that fulfills the human heart, Jesus. God is calling you to true joy, knowing Jesus personally. Lord, Teach Me to Pray is free. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com, click on the red box, order the Lord, Teach Me to Pray series now. Go to LordTeachMeToPray.com.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. St. John the Apostle records the John chapter 6 Bread of Life discourse, in which Jesus states that His flesh is true food and His blood true drink. Who better to understand John's writings and subsequent teachings than a disciple and student of John, St. Ignatius of Antioch? In his letter to the Smyrnians in 110 AD, Ignatius writes, "I have no taste for corruptible food, nor for the pleasures of this life. I desire the bread of God, which is the flesh of Jesus Christ. And for drink, I desire His blood, which is love incorruptible." The Catholic Church absolutely follows St. John and St. Ignatius in taking Jesus at His word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
All right, short on time here. Let me take a quick one. In many cases, Dr. Ray, adversity can help faith grow, as we see and hear with the persecuted Christians in the Middle East. Well, it's not a straight line relationship when there's heavy persecution in many countries where Christianity once had a strong foothold. It does tend to be squished. But for those who cling to the faith, it becomes much more their life raft. Are we seeing in the United States, where we live more securely and comfortably, that faith wanes or does not grow as strong? Yeah, I think that is a very safe relationship. I heard once a missionary to communist China who said that when the people were feeling persecuted, they were more open to Christianity's message. But when they got comfortable, they didn't need it as much. Now, obviously, you don't want persecution to be the main method of spreading the faith. However, there is truth to the fact that you get spiritually lazy, complacent, and if life is going fairly comfortably for you, then God can be put on a shelf. You bring him down when there's some kind of crisis or illness or loss, but for the most part, he's not really occupying your thinking. That seems to be the case in the U.S., and I don't think it's an accident that so many young people, as never before, are claiming they have no religion. Now, there's been some kind of leveling out of this, and there's been actually a little bit of a rise in the Gen Zers returning to faith, returning to church, more among boys than girls. But the percentage is still not enough to counter the 40% who say, nah, we don't really have any religion. One of the factors, of course, is our culture is very, very good, at presenting morality or immorality as attractive and seductive and fun. And you need to be tolerant to accept any kind of sinfulness. That's a big factor. Another factor is this. Comfort. It is safe to say that the younger generation has, as a group, known more comfort and ease of existence and material well-being than generations before them. My parents were solidly middle class. They lived in a 1,200 square foot house, one bathroom, no air condition, one car. Dad worked at a factory. We didn't go out to eat, couldn't afford it, but we were middle class. Nowadays, so many kids, even kids that live in situations that you wouldn't consider real stable materially, are very comfortable. So when that happens, it is easy to become immersed in your lifestyle as it now is, and God just sort of fades into the background. The whole question of God, the whole question of paying attention to him, the whole question of, am I going to live counterculturally with my morals, is not one that you wrestle with. I saw an interesting set of statements. It said, hard times create strong men. Forgive the use of men to allude to people. Hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. Run that by again, because I know some people are going to say, Dr. E, what was that? I didn't get it all. I was driving. Hard times create strong men. You got to contend with the times. Okay, you've got to survive. It's like the greatest generation of World War II. Some of the things my grandparents used to tell me, my mom and dad used to tell me about World War II in the country, it was incredible. Some of the stuff, even in one lifetime, that they lived so differently. So hard times create strong men. Strong men create good times. The boom, the incredible boom of the U.S. in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in terms of the plenty and the comforts and the surge in material well-being. So strong men create good times. Good times create weak men. You become complacent. You become soft. You become less able to deal with frustration and crises and setbacks. So good times create weak men. Weak men create hard times. Because you don't have the strength of will, the strength of perseverance, the strength of competition to create good living conditions, and weak men create hard times. Okay. I remember that. Thank you for joining me here, and the doctor is in. Andrew Krucek for your producer man and your board operations there at Ave Maria. Appreciate the company so very, very much. Good Lord permitting. Talk to you tomorrow. Thank you for joining me. Walk with God. That will create spiritually good times.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRRay.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.